Welcome to the Herpetile Podcast. My name is Nash and I love herpetology. This podcast explores all things to do with reptiles and amphibians. I hope you like it.
Welcome to the show. My name is Nash and I'm the host of the Herpetile Podcast. My guest today is Dr. Julia Riley. Julia is an ecologist that researches animal behavior, evolutionary ecologist, and conservation. Julia's work covers animal cognition, developmental plasticity, overwintering ecology, urban ecology, natural history of reptiles, and conservation biology. Julia is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Botany and Zoology at Stellenbosch University in South Africa and is also a postdoctoral fellow at Dalhousie University in Canada. She's also the adjunct professor in the department of biology at Laurentian University of Canada. Welcome to the show, Julia.
Thanks, Nash, for the introduction. Thanks for having me.
I hope I pronounced everything correctly.
You did it very well. That was a lot of stuff to say.
Yeah. My first question for you today is how and when did you first become interested in working with animals?
That question brings me back. I think I really grew up a lot with nature. Both of my parents are botanists. And so I was always going camping and going hiking. And I really loved nature from a really young age. But I think I decided to work with animals when I started my undergraduate degree. And I really realized I wanted to try to help something and make a positive change in it. And I wanted to help animals because I loved animals so much. So I started to study to be a vet. But along the way, I got distracted by science and learning more about the natural history of animals. And I got more and more interested in herpetology. And I think that's really when I decided to pursue researching reptiles as a profession was in my undergrad, and I haven't stopped since. I kind of got a bit obsessed with it.
So some of your work looks at evolution of sociality in reptiles. Can you explain what sociality is?
Yes, I can. That's a very complicated question. And a lot of people like to debate about the proper definition for sociality. But I study sociality on a really broad sense of the term. So sociality to me is when really there's an social interaction between two animals. And usually this would be animals of the same species. And this could be aggressive interaction, a territorial interaction, or it could be beneficial, like a cooperative interaction between two individuals of the same species. But that kind of more basic definition allows us to investigate sociality across the broad diversity of animals that we have in this world. So oftentimes when you think about social animals, a lot of people think about chimpanzees or elephants, and they are indeed very social animals. But sometimes the definitions that are used to research those groups of animals don't really apply so directly to reptiles, which are also can be very social. So that's why I use a more simple definition for sociality when in my research.
A few episodes ago, I interviewed Melissa Amarello from the Advocates of Snake Preservation. And we talked a bit about how rattlesnakes can live in groups and families and care for their young. Would you call that sociality?
Yes, most definitely. That's sociality for sure. And that's definitely, we're seeing that more and more in reptiles and learning more and more about kind of their secret social lives that have been maybe overlooked for, in my opinion, too long.
How do you study that?
Study their social behavior?
Yes.
Yes. So it depends on kind of the reptile that you're studying. Some reptiles you're more able to observe them in the wild, whereas some reptiles like snakes if you're close by them, they can be very aware of the fact that you're there. But for my research so far, I've studied lizards the most and their social behavior. And lizards can be they're aware that you're there, but they still exhibit their natural behaviors. And so I kind of just go around a study site. I will catch all the lizards I can in a population, and then I mark them so that I know what individual is which. So how I do that is I put a sticker on them, and it kind of looks, I kind of think of it like a sports jersey. So I put a sticker with a number on it, so I know that's lizard number 23, and this another lizard's lizard number 53. And then I walk around the study site, and I observe them from a distance with binoculars, and I write down who's basking with who, who's chasing who, who's hanging out with who. And then I do that over a long period of time. And then I can understand which lizards are socially interacting with other lizards and what are the nature of those social interactions. So it's a lot of fun field work, actually, that I'm really lucky and been able to do. And I've spent a lot of time in the field watching lizards and their natural behaviors.
So in that research, do you have a species that you focus on?
So in Australia, I focused on a lizard called the Australian tree skink, which is what part of the Agernia group of social lizards in Australia that you probably know a lot about. It includes the blue-tongued lizard, the shinglebacks or sleepy lizards, and then also the gidgee skinks are just some of the examples from that group. But I studied just that one species. Here in South Africa, the reason why I'm in South Africa is I'm studying the girdled lizards or cordylid lizards. And I study a few species of cordylids, but one of my favorites to study is the armadillo lizard. And they can live in groups of up to 30 individuals. So that's really impressive when you see a whole group of lizards on a rock and there's 30 of them all basking together.
So then what do you think the benefits are for reptiles to live together or bask together versus living alone?
That's a really good question and something that research is still trying to really get a concrete answer on. But some of the research so far, we've found that when lizards bask together, they can be less vigilant. So that means they can spend less time watching for predators and more time just concentrating on basking or getting a good thermoregulatory, getting to the right temperature. And they still have a really good response if a predator shows up because they have a lot of people looking out at the same time. And then some other things that we've found is that they can benefit through temperature regulation. So when lizards are in a group all together, they actually keep the warmth that they've accumulated for longer than if they were just by themselves. Then they're more at the whim of temperature increases and decreases that are in the environment. And we also know that, especially with juveniles, if juveniles or offspring stay with their parents for a long, long period of time after they've been born, we know that they get the benefits of being in a group as well. But then also they get to have access to the same resources like shelter sites that the parents have, as well as they get protection from their parents from other members of the same species that might be a bit aggressive towards these offspring. So there seem to be a lot of benefits, but there are definitely also potentially costs of living in a social group. So we really have to try to understand what is the cost benefit trade-off to living in a social group for reptiles still.
So then is your study focused on the reptiles that Do you live in groups or both, like studying versus, or the ones that don't live in groups?
So I, for my work on sociality in reptiles, and especially in South Africa, I've tried to study four species that vary in their, in how much they live in groups. So one lizard called the Karoo girdled lizard, it really doesn't live in groups that often. Sometimes it does. You can observe it to adults together, probably males and females, or maybe an adult with a juvenile, but they don't really spend a lot of time basking together or staying in groups. Whereas on that other spectrum, the armadillo lizards, you hardly ever see them alone. So I'm trying to kind of understand, okay, well, what is the diversity of their social behavior? What are the two extremes and what's in the middle? And how can we better understand the factors and the ecology around this behavior and trying to understand, okay, well, how did this evolve and what are the differences between these species?
So I watched a documentary about Romulus Whitaker's work with king cobras in India, and I noticed that when the king cobra eggs hatch, the babies stay together a few days and then leave to go alone, and that many of them won't survive during that. Wouldn't it be in their interest to stay together longer?
Well, it's hard to know. But it is interesting that they stay together for a couple of days after they hatch. And a lot of snakes seem to do this where after they hatch or they're born, the babies stay together for a certain amount of time, or they stay with their parent if they're born for an extended period of time. But it is hard to know what maybe the costs of staying together in a group for a longer period of time are too high. And so then they decide to disperse after a period of time. Because if a predator comes along and sees 20 baby snakes all together, it might be easier for that predator to be able to eat more of them than if they were dispersed. So we don't really know exactly what those cost benefits are yet. So much more research needs to be done on reptile sociality so we can start to get a better understanding of their social behaviors and why sometimes they're in groups and why sometimes they're not in groups.
Mm-hmm. So you also research evolutionary ecology that looks at how animals interact with their environment and how that affects their evolutionary adaptions. What are the most interesting things you've discovered in your research?
That's a hard question. So evolutionary ecology is very interesting because I've always really been interested in how the environment plays a role in reptile biology because they're ectotherms, right? So they're so reliant on their environment and basically the temperature in it and all the other factors that are in an environment. I really enjoy studying urban ecology because in urban areas, the environment is so different than a natural environment. But some reptiles really thrive still in urban environments, like the eastern water dragon in Australia. You can see them all over Sydney, and they seem to be very, very happy in this urban landscape. So work I did in collaboration with my partner, James Baxter Gilbert, found that basically in urban environments, lizards seem to be bolder, even right after they hatch out of the egg, than lizards in natural environments. So something about being bolder in urban environments seems to be allowing these lizards survive and succeed in urban environments, which I think is really quite cool to try to understand how these lizards are surviving so well and thriving in urban areas.
Do you have any like guesses about that?
I think maybe because of the presence of humans in urban environments, if you are bolder and willing to take more risks, maybe you can be out basking for longer in areas where there's lots of people around. One of the areas where we see a lot of water dragons is on the Manly Boardwalk, which is a really popular beach in Sydney. And a lot of people walk along this boardwalk at pretty much every day of the year. And so if a lizard was shy, then they likely would have to come out and then retreat a lot if they weren't comfortable with people around or were willing to take risks. So being a bit bolder probably allows them to be more active when humans are also really active, and also probably allows them to take advantage of new food sources. They're really maybe willing to try a piece of popcorn that's been left on the ground rather than being quite shy about it. And maybe that allows them to try new things and adapt more quickly in this new urban environment that is much, much busier than a natural environment would be.
So how come you, don't you think that it would still be in their interest to do the same thing in the wild? Because then I guess they could do the same thing with things that might scare them in the wild, like in the bush.
Perhaps, but maybe they're not as exposed to humans, and so they're not sure if the humans might react negatively towards them like other predators might be. So maybe in the bush there are more predators and they have a mixed experience with them. Probably the predators might try to eat them, and so they might treat humans the same way, and they might not get so acclimated to their presence and be able to be bolder. But it's quite interesting because the water dragons, right out of the egg, without any experience in the city, are bolder. So that's quite interesting to me because there seems to be a genetic component to it as well. It's not just learned experience. So there is definitely something going on that's in their DNA in that's changing them to be bolder in urban environments. But it's a bit complicated to understand exactly why that's happening.
Julia, you research evolutionary ecology. How do you research that? Like, what's the process of researching it?
So there's lots of different ways you can research evolutionary ecology, and it's a really broad field. So a lot of my work actually fits into the umbrella of evolutionary ecology, like my work on lizard social behavior, my work looking at how different environmental factors can change the morphology of reptiles, and if that has to do with predator-prey dynamics or if that has to do with environmental factors. So really, it's quite a broad field, and so you can research it by doing field work, or you can and collecting size and morphological data, which is like the size of the lizard, the size of its limbs, or the reptile, or even doing experimental work where you take animals back into the lab and record their behavior. So there's lots of different ways that you can actually study evolutionary ecology, as long as you're considering the ecology of the animal, the environmental factors it experiences, and basically its interactions with other animals in the landscape. So it's a really broad topic.
So through your work in that topic, what have you found out?
So there's a lot that I found out with my collaborators about evolutionary ecology. There's been some amazing work that we've done, especially in the social behavior of lizards. A colleague of mine, Isabel, she did this really interesting study, I think, where we looked at, can an invasive species of lizard, the wall lizard that lives in Europe, if it's been introduced to a new area, can it learn from other lizards in that new area and learn information about where there's shelter sites or where there's food resources? So can it socially learn from a native species in that area? And we found that yes, that invasive lizards can both learn from other lizards of the same species, but also lizards that are exist around it and that they share the same habitat with, which I thought was quite an interesting result, because it shows that maybe if an introduced lizard or an introduced animal is trying to adapt to a novel environment, a new environment it's never been to before, it can actually learn from the animals around it to get information and learn how to adapt in this new environment.
So do you have some examples of species that do this?
So that particular study was on the Italian wall lizard, Podarcis sicula, and they were learning from the Iberian wall lizard, Podarcis varensens, those animals were captured from Lisbon, Portugal. So those are the species that we studied and found out that we're learning from each other.
How did you find that out?
So what we did and what Isabel spent a lot of time doing was in Lisbon, Portugal, these lizards live together. So you can find them in the same place. And she went and she captured lizards from the wild and then brought them back into the lab. And we did what's called a learning assay. So basically we gave these lizards a task that they needed to learn. The task they needed to learn was we had little dishes of food, and the lizard either had to learn to eat from a dish with a blue lid versus a dish with a red lid. So the one with the red lid didn't have any food in it. And so we would say, okay, well, you have to learn to eat from the dish with the blue lid. And over time, after being exposed to this over time, they learned that task. And then we found out that the individuals that could watch a lizard doing it correctly, regardless of if that lizard was the same species as it, or if it was a different species, learned this learning task faster than lizards that had to figure it out on their own. So it was mainly an experiment in the lab that allowed us to learn this. But we think that this information from the lab likely can transfer to wild populations. But it would be really neat to study something like that as well in the wild.
Why do you think that one lizard would start learning off another? Do you think it would be because, the lizard does something that might help them, so the other one would want to do the same thing?
Yes, I think it's a lot like us when we are learning a hard task. So say there's a math problem that you have to learn and it's really complicated and it's really hard to learn by yourself. But if you're just learning it by yourself, a lot of the time what you have to do is what's called trial and error learning. You just have to try something out and it might be right and it might be wrong. And if it's wrong, you have to try it again. And this process takes a lot of time. You have to try a lot of times over and over and over again. But if you have the help of a friend, or you can watch someone else do the math problem, oftentimes you can learn it much quicker by seeing someone else do it first. And so we see this a lot in the wild as well with animals, including reptiles, where if an animal can see another animal doing a task, whether that is finding a safe shelter or doing a task, a puzzle to access food, if they can watch a member of the same species, or in this case, a member of a different species with these lizards do it first, it's much quicker for them to learn. So they don't have to go through this very tedious process of trial and error learning. So it actually allows them to probably learn much faster and get what they need, if it's food or shelter, much faster.
So do you have a favorite example of a species that does this?
Well, one of my favorite lizards, the Australian tree skink that I saved for my PhD, is a social species. So they live in small groups with relatives. And we found out that they socially learn from each other. So that's probably one of my favorite examples.
How many? And is it only lizards that do this, or do you know that any other animals do this?
Lots of other animals do this. So crows and parrots can do it. And also crows and parrots are just very intelligent individually as well, not only socially, but also lots of primates do it, like chimpanzees. Have you ever heard about the chimpanzees that fish from termite mounds? So they use a long stick, and they fish in termite mounds, and then they pull out this stick, and it will have termites on it, and then they lick it off. And they socially learn that from other members in their troops. So a lot of animals do this behavior, and actually, it's only recently that we're uncovering this social learning behavior in reptiles. But I think it's probably an important part of how they adapt and learn and survive in the wild.
Do you keep any animals?
I don't keep, well, I have a dog right now. He's a very lovely dog, and he comes out in the field with me, actually, and really enjoys hanging out while I catch lizards. But I did have reptiles more when I was growing up, and I wish I could have a few now, but I live away from home because I'm Canadian. And so once maybe I have a more permanent position, I'll be able to get some more reptiles.
So if you could tell everyone in the world something about reptiles or amphibians, what would it be?
Whew. That's a hard question. There's lots I'd like to tell them about reptiles and amphibians. I think one thing is that for a long time, reptiles and amphibians have really been thought of as perhaps robotic or unlike us, so unlike humans. And we haven't been able to really see behaviors that remind us of humans in them. So like with chimpanzees, some of their behaviors are very similar to us. They groom each other, and they care for their young really obviously in the similar ways that humans care for their young. But that doesn't mean, just because reptile behaviors don't look like our behaviors, doesn't mean that they don't have similar behaviors. We're learning so much more now about reptiles and amphibians and the fact that they are social, that they can live with relatives and in family groups for sometimes their whole lives, that they can care for their young. It's just in a way that's different to mammals and birds. And so and that they do learn from each other, just like we learn from our friends in school. So I think that with more time, we really will learn more and more about how the similarities between reptiles and ourselves, and that really we shouldn't think of them as so different to ourselves, and think of them as, no, they are really similar to us, and they have personalities. They have hang out with family members. They hang out with friends, and maybe they aren't so different to us, and maybe that will allow us to have more empathy towards them and realize that they are just as important as other animals in the world to conserve and care for.
So my final question for you today is, what is an unusual fact about reptiles or amphibians that people might not know?
Oh, that's a great question. An unusual fact. Well, one of the interesting things that I found out when I was here in South Africa is that there's a species of gecko that makes burrows, and the species is called the barking gecko. Actually, there's a couple species of them. And these barking geckos, they call all night long and they attract mates. Very, very similar to frogs. And I think that that's such an amazing thing to think about, a lizard that has such a loud voice and actually calls for a mate. And I think that's kind of an unusual fun fact about a lizard. Most people think lizards are quite quiet, but these lizards in the nighttime in the Kalahari Desert are so loud, and that's all you can hear. So that's probably one of my favorite facts.
Thank you so much for being on the Herpetile podcast today, Julia.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming. I'll put links to Julia's social media and websites in the description too.
Thanks so much, Nash.
Thanks for listening to the Herpetile podcast. Please subscribe so you don't miss out on any of the latest episodes. Happy herping!